See, with that fall in the garden, nature was regarded as corrupt. There's a myth for you that corrupts the whole world for us.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
Hi, my name's Madeline, and I'm going to talk about two myths. The earth was dark, and the gods decided to make a moon and a sun. And then a god stepped forward. He was the most vain god and wanted to be the brightest thing in the sky. But they picked the most humblest goddess to be the moon. Then they lit a fire, and the vain guy was supposed to jump in, but each time he was supposed to, then he was too scared and stepped back. Then the humblest goddess tried. She was not afraid and stepped in. An eagle swooped down and pulled a ball of fire up into the sky. Well, the vain god was afraid that he would not be the brightest thing in the sky, so he jumped in. But then a raven swooped down and pulled him out. He was the moon. It comes from Mexico. There was a dragon who made volcanoes and serpents and flood and other things like that. The gods were afraid, so they made a god called Marduk. He got fighting things, a bow and arrows, and a net and a mace. And then he went to the she dragon, and she opened her mouth to swallow him, but he sent a giant wind into her mouth, so she could not close her jaws. So, while she struggled, he shot an arrow down to her belly and put her into the net and tore her up into pieces and made the universe and earth, heaven and earth.
So that was a myth from Mesopotamia.
The Inuit tell about the goddess of the sea, Sedna. She was once an Inuit maiden, but she became a goddess of the sea, and this is how it happened. She was very beautiful, and many men came to court her, but she refused them all. Her father was worried that she would not get a husband, but she said to him, "The man I have dreamed of will come to me." Then the man that she had dreamed of came, but as he spoke to her, telling her to come, then a warning blew in the wind. But she put aside her doubts and stretched out a hand. With a happy cry, they left in his ship. She wanted to bring her dog, Sedka, but no matter how much she called, he would not come. She taught him how to make a proper igloo. There was always lots of food and clothes. And then one day, her husband went on a hunt without his lucky amulet. She followed for a while until she rounded a bend and saw him change in shape, and he grew huge white wings and flew up into the sky, and she knew the terrible truth. She had married a bird spirit. Her father had come. His friend had put a blessing on his boat and gave him a magic formula to keep their boat safe. When he saw her pacing up down the shore, looking worried, she told him what her husband really was, and he insisted that she come home with him. They paddled off. When her husband came back and discovered she had fled, first he cried and raged, then he set out to bring her back. Her father threw her from the ship, the boat, because the waves were calling, "Give Sedna back to us." So he thought he must have upset very great spirits. And he threw her into the waves. 3 times she attempted to get back into the boat. At last, exhausted, she fell down to the bottom. And then 2 seal spirits came and told her, "You must go to that mountain to reach your destiny." She walked through the kingdom of the dead. The spirits called to her, "Come with them and leave her task." But she did not. Then she saw a killer whale, and it looked so ferocious, he stopped and said, "Alas." But the spirits, one of them told her, "Do not be afraid," and the other told her, "Climb onto his back. He will carry you to the mountain." So she clung on tight, and then it stopped. It took her most of the way and then stopped at a bridge as thin as a knife and told her, "It's the last task. You must cross this bridge on foot." And so she balanced very carefully and walked across. It stopped some ways from the mountain, so she jumped off and swam to the mountain. She was given a throne, and all the animals of the sea promised her that she was their queen, and they would obey her every command. And they said to her, "You have magical powers, but you must use them carefully, for a god uses his powers wisely and mercifully." Realizing this was a test, and sensing that her powers might be taken away from her if she did not use them properly, she fulfilled her greatest desire. She moved her fingers and power flowed from her hands. She ordered the animals to swallow up her father's igloo. They did, and they brought him and her wolf to her. Her father was afraid, seeing her magic powers all around her, and fearing that she would punish him for not using his heart. But she forgave him, made him a home on the mountain. She made her dog her special guardian. She helps the people that need help. And sometimes when the wind blows, you can hear Sedna's song, saying, "My joy floats to the surface like bubbles that burst in the light."
People say that what we're all seeking is a meaning for life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think what we're seeking is an experience of being alive, so that the life experiences that we have on the purely physical plane will have resonances within that are those of our own innermost being and reality. And so that we actually feel the rapture of being alive. That's what it's all finally about, and that's what these clues help us to find within ourselves. Myths are clues to the spiritual potentialities of the human life. The mind has to do with meaning. In here, what's the meaning of a flower? That Zen story of the sermon of the Buddha, when his whole company was gathered and he simply lifted a flower. And there's only one man, Kashyapa, who gave him a sign with his eye that he understood what was said. What's the meaning of the universe? What's the meaning of a flea? It's just there, that's it. And your own meaning is that you're there. Now we are so engaged in doing things to achieve purposes of outer value that we forget that the inner value, the rapture that is associated with being alive, is what it's all about. Now, we want to think about God. God is a thought. God is a name. God is an idea. But its reference is to something that transcends all thinking. The ultimate mystery of being is beyond all categories of thought. My friend Heinrich Zimmer of years ago used to say, the best things can't be told, because they transcend thought. The second best are misunderstood, because those are the thoughts that are supposed to refer to that which can't be thought about, you know? And one gets stuck with the thoughts. The third best are what we talk about, you see? And a myth is that field of reference, metaphors referring to what is absolutely transcendent. And the ultimate word in our language for that which is transcendent is God. The idea of God, that he's a bearded old man of some kind with certain not very pleasant temperament. That is, I would say, a sort of materialistic way of talking about the transcendent.
There's just the opposite of it, found on an island in the harbor of Bombay from around the 8th century.
This is a wonderful cave. You enter the cave from a bright sky. Of course, moving into the darkness, your eyes are blanked out. But if you just keep walking slowly, gradually the eyes adjust, and this enormous thing, it's about 19 feet high and 19 feet across. The central head is the mask of eternity. This is the mask of God.
Mask of eternity.
That is the metaphor through which eternity is to be experienced as a radiance.
And these other two figures?
Whenever one moves out of the transcendent, one comes into a field of opposites. These two pairs of opposites come forth as male and female from the two sides. One has eaten of the tree of the knowledge, not only of good and evil, but of male and female, of right and wrong, of this and that, and light and dark. Everything in the field of time is dual, past and future, dead and alive. All this, being and non-being, is, isn't.
And what's the significance of them being beside the mask of God, the mask of eternity? What is this sculpture saying to us?
The mask represents the middle, and the two represent the two opposites. And they always come in pairs, and put your mind in the middle. Most of us put our minds on the side of the good against what we think of as evil. It was Heraclitus, I think, who said, for God, all things are good and right and just, but for man, some things are right and others are not. You're in the field of time when you're man. And one of the problems of life is to live in the realization of both terms. That's to say, I know the center, and I know that good and evil are simply temporal apparitions.
Well, are some myths more or less true than others?
They're true in different senses, do you see? Here's a whole mythology based on the insight that transcends duality. Ours is a mythology that's based on the insight of duality. And so our religion tends to be ethical in its accent. Sin and atonement, right and wrong.
You are listening to Radio Free School.
I once heard a wonderful lecture by Daisetsu Suzuki. You remember this wonderful old Zen philosopher who was over here? He was in his 90s. He started a lecture in Switzerland that I heard in Ascona. He stood up with his hands on his side and he said, God against man, man against God, man against nature, nature against man, nature against God, God against nature. Very funny religion. Now, in the other mythologies, one puts oneself in accord with the world. If the world is a mixture of good and evil, you do not put yourself in accord with it. You identify with the good and you fight against the evil. And this is a religious system which belongs to the Near East following Zarathustra's time. It's in the biblical tradition all the way in Christianity and Islam as well. this business of not being with nature, and we speak with a sort of derogation of the nature religions. You see, with that fall in the garden, nature was regarded as corrupt. There's a myth for you that corrupts the whole world for us. And every spontaneous act is sinful because nature is corrupt and has to be corrected, must not be yielded to. You get a totally different civilization, a totally different way of living according to your myth as to whether nature is fallen or whether nature is itself a manifestation of divinity, and the spirit being the revelation of the divinity that's inherent in nature.
But don't you think that Americans, modern Americans, have rejected this idea, this Indian idea, this ancient idea of nature as revealing the divinity because it would have kept us from achieving dominance over nature?
Yeah, but that's the biblical condemnation of nature that they inherited from their own religion and brought with them. God is not in nature. God is separate from nature, and nature is not God. And this distinction between God and the world is not to be found in basic Hinduism or Buddhism.
Gilgamesh was a strong person, Gilgamesh, and he made his people build a wall, and they said to the gods, make us a new man so we don't have to work so hard and fight. And so the gods sent Enkidu, which was a really strong man, but...
Where did he live?
Of the animals. Remember? And there was a hunter that set up the traps, and so when his net was gone, and he tried to shoot a lion, but someone jumped out.
Enkidu
jumped out and took the lion away to safety.
And what did that hunter do?
And he fled back to Gilgamesh.
And what did he tell Gilgamesh?
There's a strong man. There's a strong man. Go back and get him. But when he tried, he wouldn't come.
So what did they do? What was their plan?
And they got a beautiful dancer, and then she danced, and then he fell in love with her. And she said, follow me up to Gilgamesh. But he didn't want to leave his animal friends, but he came with her. And then when he came to Path, he wouldn't let him. And Gilgamesh wouldn't let him, so he hit him. And then he hit him back. And then the fight really began. And Enkidu said enough. And so they shook hands, and they became good friends, best friends. And then they went on many adventures, and then he died.
Persephone and the Pomegranate, a myth from Greece. A long time ago, when gods and goddesses still lived among humans, Demeter, goddess of the harvest, had a daughter named Persephone, whom she treasured more than the earth. Together they roamed through forests and fields, as Demeter brought forth food and flowers from the soil. Persephone loved her mother's company, and was rarely seen apart from her. One day, as she gathered blossoms in a distant meadow, Persephone noticed a flower unlike any other she had ever seen. It was a narcissus, so deep a red it was almost black. Its unusual color frightened her. Persephone did not pick it, but instead went home. She did not tell her mother about it. That night, Persephone dreamt of the blood-red narcissus turning into a cool, ripe fruit, too delicious to eat. Abruptly, she awoke. She slipped out of bed and ran to the meadow where she had seen the flower. The narcissus was still there, luminous in the light from the full moon. She forgot her fear and bent to pluck it. Suddenly, the earth split in two. Persephone screamed, dropped the narcissus. Out of the abyss leapt a gold chariot, pulled by four black horses. Its driver, a tall man, seized Persephone by the waist and pulled her into the chariot. Down, down they sped. Above them the earth sealed shut with a shudder. Demeter was awakened by the echoes of her daughter's last cry. Persephone! She called out again and again to the calm night, but there was no answer. Demeter searched frantically until the sun rose. She did not find her daughter. 13 days and nights passed. Still Demeter looked, never stopping for rest nor food. Each evening the moon waned thinner and gave off less and less light. By the 14th night, the moon showed her ebony face. Demeter had travelled to the far ends of the earth and waited for Hecate, goddess of the dark moon, to appear. The sky was black, as though a veil had been thrown over even the brightest stars. After a short time, a ghostly figure approached Demeter. Sister, Hecate said, I know why you seek my help, but I do not know where Persephone is. Perhaps Helios of the All-Seeing Sun can tell us. Together, Demeter and Hecate journeyed past the clouds to the top of the high mountain where Helios, the sun god, lived. Nothing can be done to help Persephone, Helios told Demeter. She has been abducted by Pluto, lord of the underworld, to become his wife and rule over the dead. But Pluto does love your daughter, and he's not an unworthy son-in-law. Demeter wept, thinking of her daughter inside the earth, where no sun fell, nor flowers grew. Surely Zeus, ruler of us all, help!
Zeus won't, goddess.
He gave Pluto permission to marry your daughter. Demeter's sorrow quickly turned to anger. Then I will not let the wheat grow. Let the earth be as barren as this mother's heart. Immediately trees began to wither and grass turned brown with death. Deep in the underworld, surrounded by dark stone walls, Persephone sat next to Pluto on a richly jeweled throne. A heavy golden crown rested upon her brow. Pale spirits danced gracefully before the king and queen to lighten their hearts, but Persephone looked away so that no one could see her tears. My wife, I have given you a kingdom to rule, incomparable riches and my love, Pluto said. How can I please you? Persephone answered, I miss my mother. I miss the sun and the green forests. I'm not used to darkness, my lord. Still, you have not eaten anything. Nor shall I until I am reunited with my mother, she replied. Perhaps this will awaken your appetite, said Pluto. He placed before Persephone a pomegranate as red and rich in colour as that unearthly Narcissus had been. From the fruit seeped a luscious fragrance. Tempted, Persephone held the pomegranate carefully and felt its cool surface upon her palms. On the earth, without Demeter's guidance, the trees remained barren of fruit and wheat did not grow. For the first time, winter visited the earth. Ice formed on tree branches and snow covered the ground, softening the cries of hungry birds. In her grief, Demeter disguised herself as an old hag and wandered aimlessly mourning Persephone. During her travels, some recognized the goddess despite her rags. No matter how they begged her to make spring return, Demeter refused. Zeus observed this, yet remained steadfast in his decision. But when mortal men and women began to starve, he finally surrendered to Demeter. He agreed to reunite Persephone with her mother, but only if she had not eaten. The earth opened, allowing a brief ray of sunlight to enter the underworld, before it closed once more. Even in the darkness, Persephone could see the brilliant corn color of Demeter's hair. Mother! She cried joyously as she ran into the goddess's arms. You have come for me! I can go home with you! Yes, my darling. But first, Demeter's anxious eyes searched Persephone's face. Tell me, have you eaten anything since you have been here? If you have, you must stay. Persephone said she had not, but could not meet her mother's gaze. Pluto stepped down from his throne to take his wife's hands away from Demeter's. Then Persephone, where's the pomegranate I gave you? I know not, Persephone answered meekly. It must be found before you leave me. Surely you remember where it is? Still Persephone denied knowing. They persisted with their questions. Finally, Persephone yielded the fruit from a fold in her gown. Her face was pale and nervous. 6 seeds were missing from the pomegranate. Persephone stays, Pluto shouted. She has eaten. She has only tasted a few seeds, protested Demeter. If my daughter does not return with me, I shall die of grief. Now Persephone stepped forward. She stood between her mother and her husband with a new serenity and strength. I shall decide this matter, she said. True, I have eaten of the pomegranate, but my husband, if you love me, you will understand that I am not a creature of darkness. Allow me to return to the sun and flowers I love. Allow me to leave with my mother, and I will return to you 6 months of the year, a month for each eaten seed. Pluto was silent. He could find little fault with Persephone's logic, and he did love her. With sadness, he allowed her to leave. Alone, he held the pomegranate. Over the land, snow melted into rushing brooks, carrying water to nurture new life. Ice dissolved from the trees, which began to bloom over the harsh winter, after the harsh winter. Sweet-smelling flowers blossomed over fields and forests. Once again, Persephone and her mother walked through the meadows, enjoying each other's company, even more because of their separation. But every year, after the harvest is brought in, Persephone always remembers her promise to Pluto and returns to him. Then Demeter grieves and brings on winter. 6 months later, when Persephone reappears from the dark underworld, Demeter rejoices and the earth blooms again with spring.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.